Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Backlog Battle Podcast. This is Alex. This is Season 8, Discover, Play Together. And in case this is the first episode you've ever listened to of the show in this season, we're going to be talking with a bunch of gamers from all walks of life, talking about what they do, what they play, and all sorts of really fun stuff that you might not have thought about before or learned about before. And today we're going to be talking to Katrina. She is a localization specialist, and she's worked on a whole bunch of anime, manga, games that you might be familiar with. So welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So to kind of give people a background of how I know you, like, I follow you on Twitter, and from time to time you drop these nuggets of cultural information in Japanese on certain decisions, you know, you made in certain kinds of anime or manga that you've worked on. And I just want to say, like, how profound that is to just wake up one day and here's a long 12 tweet thread of like everything that you thought about things, and it's so insightful. I just wanted to say that first and foremost.
Thank you. Translation theory is one of like my big passions, and like pretty much nobody knows what it is, but it's basically like the science and linguistics behind how certain decisions get made in translation. So it's really cool to, you know, every once in a while I wake up and I see someone post like a hot take or like a really cool line. I'm just like, oh man, this is why this is so cool. And like post a whole like graduation level thesis on this stupid shit. And everyone, people want to read it. So I'm super down, but it's, translational localization is it's so complex. And I think a lot of people are now, especially like monolingual Westerners, are starting to realize through consumption of more and more localized media, like, oh, this isn't just like you throw something into Google Translate and it comes back out. Like, this is a big ass process.
Yeah, it is. It's like there's so much context that's lost when you just throw something in Google Translate. I'm trying to figure out like if there was a time that I did that for a video, and I know one time and I kind of forgot the context of it, funny enough. To kind of going back to you though, like, so was this something that you went to school for, like localization theory or translation theory?
Yes. Okay. So I got my bachelor's from University of Irvine in Japanese and psychology. And then I went to Kent State University to get my master's degree in translation, specifically Japanese translation. So I do only Japanese to English. I don't go the other way around. And that master's degree was centered around translation theory and philosophy. And our graduation thesis was we would translate something and then spend 20 to 30 pages talking about all the different decisions we made, the translation theory that backed up the translation choices that we made, et cetera, et cetera. And then we would go through a review process with prominent translators who would come in and be like, oh, I think like Francine Nord would be a much better example here for why you're using this functionalist theory kind of thing. So translation theory was really at the center of all the translation learning that we did. And it's something that even now, you know, 5-6 years out of that program, I'm utilizing every day. Just because it's easier to have, you know, you'll have more confidence in yourself, and, you know, you can make more difficult choices when you can sit down and go, this is why I did it. Right. You know, like the chef being able to explain, well, this is why I added more salt, or this is why I turned up the heat. You know, understanding the processes that lie behind a really good translation help you make those similar choices and other things that you'll be working on. So I know translation theory is super cool. My professor of translation theory, Dr. Angelone over at Kent State, right as I was graduating, he's just like, Katrina, you know, you're so brilliant at this. You love this theory stuff so much. You should come with me and do a PhD. And I was like, do not tempt me, because I will, but I want to make money first. So who knows? I might go back, but I definitely really enjoying making money right now instead of, you know,
of course,
being at school for 4 more years.
That's really awesome. To kind of give you an idea of how I got exposed into, I guess, you know, the finer nuances of localization. I used to go to UCSB in Santa Barbara. Okay. So and I had for Japanese literature, mind you, I wasn't aiming for, you know, a Japanese language kind of major or anything like that. This Japanese literature class was actually taught by John Nathan. And John Nathan is known for, because he's responsible for localizing and translating Kenzaburo Oe's works to the U.S. Like, that's his shtick. So we focused a lot of the work that he did in Japanese literature and stuff, and how he translated and localized a lot of the finer nuances of the text. And that's when I kind of realized, like, okay, so this isn't just like trying to take whatever's in Japanese and figuring out how to express that in English, you have to make sure that when you do so, you know, it's as close to the original source as possible, because, you know, there's different intonations, connotations and stuff that can really affect the perception of the original piece. And for the longest time before that, like, I was like, oh, people are just, you know, fan translating things, like, this sounds pretty, you know, pretty chill and easy and stuff. And and I know what that laugh, I know what that means. And the more that I talk to people like you, the more I realize, like, okay, there is a conscious effort to sit down with a bunch of people who are doing the same thing, who are working on one game or one project, to make sure that the entire piece is aligned, that it kind of not only represents, you know, the source material, that but that everybody's kind of working at the same level. Like, let me give you a good example. Like, so let's say hypothetically, like, Majima from Yakuza is worked on by three people. If there is one person who just doesn't know that they don't need to give Majima like a southern accent or something like that, like, it kind of falls apart. And so I guess what I'm saying is, like, I've had like much higher appreciation of the localization process, like, now than I did back then, especially being exposed to people like you and the knowledge that you share on Twitter. So I guess my question is for you, like, what were your perceptions of localization and translation before you know, decided, like, hey, I'm going to study this and stuff like that?
That's a really interesting question, because I feel like I started pretty early into, like, fan translating and stuff. Like, I think it was 11th grade when I started, like, posting my first fan translations to, like 4chan and Tumblr and stuff. Way back in the day. like, it was, like, 2007. I think, and before then, most of the translated media I was consuming was either, like, manga volumes that I picked up from, like, Barnes & Noble, or I was watching a lot of fan subs of stuff way back when. Back when Crunchyroll hosted fan subs. So yeah. I watched Higurashi back in the day. Nice. But so a lot of, my Japanese level was super low back then, so I really wasn't making a connection between, like, the Japanese and the English. But I do, one thing that I do really remember was, back when Tokyopop was publishing the December 09, which I was super into in middle school. And I was so excited when I went to, like, Barnes & Noble, and I was like, oh, they have comic books for the show I see on Toonami? That's so cool. So I grabbed them. I could only grab volumes 2 and 4 because they did not have any other ones. And I grabbed it and I just, like, read it religiously. And they had, like, in the back, they had, like, oh, here's all the Japanese sound effects, like, transliterated. And it's, like, the worst fucking way to do it. Like, you do not put, like, 4 pages of, like, panel one. I'm not flipping back and forth. But no. I just remember it was, like, so interesting to me just to be like, oh, like, pochi pochi means this. And, like, bada bada means this. Like, that's so weird. That was basically my first kind of foray into it. But I definitely didn't think about it too much. You know, definitely not as a kid. And even when I was just starting to get into translation, like, I wasn't thinking a lot about, like, how someone you translate something differently than I did. Like, back when, you know, there was all the fan sub wars and, like, people were racing to get chapters out at the same time, being like, oh, why they translated that way? That way's obviously stupid. And, like, now I can kind of look back and be like, oh, they were thinking about this context and that's why they translated it this way. But before, it was kind of more like, no, that's not what that word means. Like, stop, that's not what that word means. Which, you know, unfortunately is the way a lot of people, you know, who are monolingual or, like, Western kind of look at translation out is just be like, well, why did you translate it this way? There's a couple people, a couple kohai, I would say, people who are wanting to get into translation. They'll send me questions every now and then, just be like, why did you translate this word this way? Like, doesn't it mean, like, this? Like, like my most recent example, somebody asked me, like, hey, I'm watching, like, I think they were watching Slime or something. And someone came in, they're just like, she says, like, akete kudasai, which, like, kudasai means usually is, like, a please or kind of thing. They're like, but they didn't put the word please in the subtitle. Like, does kudasai not mean that? And I'm like, well,
yeah,
no, no. Like, that's not how it works. Like, kudasai does not equal please. Like, you know, if you want me to get super pedantic and, like, super into it, like, kudasai is from kudasaru, which is from this, which is the politeness levels and blah, 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 blah. But it really goes to show that, like, even people who are starting to translate or learning translation are, they it's really hard to get out of that, this word means this, because, you know, not only are we taught that, like, all through school, like, I mean, like, fourth grade Spanish class, that's all you learn is, like agua is water, like, that's how it is. You need to memorize it that way. When in the reality, you know, it's a lot more complicated, but you're not going to tell fourth grader that because, you know, Spanish is already hard enough.
Yeah. So, exactly.
No, it's really interesting. And I think too that like maybe 10, 15 years ago, it was a lot more different because we weren't consuming as much material that had been translated. Like anime was still fairly niche. It was getting there, but it was still fairly niche. Like, you know, like if you liked Fullmetal Alchemist way back in like the day, like 2005, 2006, people were just like, oh, like that's weird. You like this thing from Japan. But mm-hmm. nowadays, like literally every high schooler is into like Boku no Hero Academia, which is crazy to me because I'm just like, shit, like people talk shit about me in high school for being a huge weeb. Like you could just be a weeb and be normal. That sucks. Well, it's great, actually. I love it. But so I think, you know, on top of that, like now that anime is getting a lot more mainstream, we're getting a lot more like foreign movies and stuff. Like Netflix is bringing over all this other stuff that's coming in dubbed into English or dubbed into or like subtitled in English. Then, of course, Parasite winning was a huge win for localization. So I think, you know, as monolingual Westerners are starting to consume more translated media, we're going to start seeing a shift in attitude as to, oh, you can't just throw shit into Google Translate and get it to come out. You know, translation is more of this kind of nebulous process, and hopefully we'll see more people learning more languages, question mark, because that'll help too. But
yeah,
no, it's definitely really interesting to see, you know, how these attitudes are going to change. Because for me, going back to your question, for me, you know, 10, 15 years ago, that was me. It was like, why are they translating it this way? That's not what Kusai means.
Yeah. So. It is kind of interesting, like, chronicling the growth and, you know, kind of evolution of Japanese to English translation over the past three decades. Because I remember, I'm an old fart, Katrina. I'm like almost 42 years old. So I've gone through, you know, everything. And I remember growing up, you know, I was exposed to Robotech, and I'm pretty sure you're aware of what happened there, where they literally took the original anime and then just dubbed over it and created like a completely different story and tried to tie three different IPs together. Or was it two? I don't really remember, but different IPs together and tried to make it into this one cohesive thing. And, you know, of course, many, many years later, we now know that Robotech's Macross, and Macross now has a presence in the West and people know about it. But I grew up in the Philippines, you know, for a good 18, 19 years. And I was exposed to Macross when, funny enough, Katrina, it was actually being dubbed from, or translated and dubbed from Japanese to English. But the English voice actors were all Filipino. So if you can imagine, there's like three levels of, or like at least two levels of separation from the original source material. Because it's like, it's Filipinos translating Japanese to Filipino and then from Filipino to English. And it's like, and it kind of worked. You're shaking your head and you're like...
That's wow. I can only imagine... what that process was like and how many times like people were in the booth just being like, I don't know, but okay, I'll say it. Like, it doesn't make sense, but okay.
Yeah.
Oh man.
It was close enough to the original source material that, you know, we kind of understood what was going on. Cause I think even at that time, there were a lot more liberties in trying to phrase things compared to the original Japanese, because I think, you know, to make it simpler and easier for people to do their work, it was much more about like, well, what is the general prevailing mood of what's happening and what is the general prevailing thing of what they're saying? And let's just kind of work towards that by the end of the scene or something like that, which is a very weird way to work.
See, though, the funny thing about that is the best way to translate, especially for dubbing. That is the way you want to do it. The further you can divorce yourself from the actual words, and like obviously there are certain instances where the specific words are tied to certain concepts and whatnot. It's all about meaning and intent, though. It's never word to word. So that kind of process is exactly what we're looking at when we do stuff like dubbing, either for games or for anime, because you know you have so many more limitations between lip flaps and like length of the shot, and you know how many words can you stuff into a certain like 5-second thing. So really, it becomes less about like, okay, we need to translate, take the subtitle and cram it into these next like 5 seconds. It really becomes like, okay, what is the mood of the scene? What is this person trying to say, and why is what she's saying important? And then reformulating that into English to make sense. That is absolutely the way you should be doing it. So it's very interesting hearing you kind of describe that. It's like, oh, that sounds so weird to do. And I'm like, no, I do it every day.
That's awesome.
But I think too, like one thought I have when you're describing that is they're using Filipino as a pivot language. And yeah. pivot language is like basically when you translate something to a middle language, like a lingua franca, it's usually French or English, and then it goes into a different language. I've been talking about this about a lot at ATA and at work, because a lot of video game companies will go from like Japanese or Chinese into English, and then go from English into French, Italian, German, Spanish, Russian, Polish, because it's cheaper and easier to do that than trying to find a Japanese to Polish translator, which there it exists, but it's much more expensive and it's much harder to get those people booked because there's so few of them. So, and of course, pivot languages have their own like issues and whatnot. Stuff gets lost in translation. If you make a mistake in English, then now it's going to go into all your other languages. But hearing you talk about how they translated from Japanese into Filipino, and then Filipino into English is very interesting to me, because in my head, I think like, okay, well, when they did Japanese to Filipino, even if they did something very literal or they didn't, you know, try to change anything in their approach there, going from Filipino to English would likely have been a different translator who was much more used to translating Filipino to English. And they probably adapted the fuck out of it, which is probably good. And what made it so, so much better than maybe a direct Japanese to English translation would have been back in the day. So I think that's really kind of really interesting, and I'd love to explore that. But
yeah, it is really interesting. And I think, you know, what's actually funny about that, too, is that at some point, you know, they did the same thing to several other pieces of anime. And then there was a thing that happened in the Philippines right around maybe the mid to late 80s, where all of a sudden, like, national, you know, Filipino nationalism became a big thing. So a lot of these things that were English were now being redubbed back into Filipino. And so it's like, so there's like this weird thing where it's like, well, it's the same voice actor who is doing it in English. Now they're doing it in Filipino. I'm like, wait a second. This is like, you know, and they did this for, you know, not just Macross. They did it for a series called Voltus 5, Deimos, and then a whole bunch of old Sentai kind of shows back in the day, which I found really funny, because if you're talking about like Filipino nationalism, why the hell are you like dubbing like Japanese anime into Filipino? Like, it's not. It's not made here, you know what I mean? Which, you know, they did dabble in animation, but that's an entirely different subject altogether. And so, okay, so you basically went to school and learned a lot of this stuff. Like, I guess a lot of people do go to school to try to learn Japanese and think that, hey, I have enough context to be able to translate a lot of this stuff. But you did something extra on top of that in order to kind of complement your understanding of how this should work. And so can you tell me a little bit about like how you got from like, hey, I want to learn Japanese to like, oh, there's something called translation theory. Like, what's that all about?
Yeah, no. So I actually never wanted to go into translation. The idea was to get my degree in psychology and then go into marriage and family therapy, or even sex therapy at one point I was looking into. So grad school was always on the board for me. And I picked up a second major in Japanese when I was in my second year of university, just because I was like, oh, you know, well, I'm gonna be taking all these Japanese classes anyways because I'm a weeb, so I might as well get a degree for it. And then it turned out I was looking into study abroad because I'm just like, I might as well. So I looked into it, and it was gonna be cheaper for me to study abroad than to stay in the States, because of course. So I ended up doing a 6-month study abroad in Japan, and while I was there, I was applying for grad school, because I'm crazy like that. So I'm applying for different grad schools, and I'm like looking at all these different psych programs, and I'm just like none of these are getting me, like none of these look really cool. Some of them were just like straight up sketch. I was like, this cannot be a real school, and I can't like figure out more information about it or go visit because I'm not in the States. Like, I'm in Japan, I'm trying to do everything via web. And then I forget who it is, either one of my professors or it might have been my mom, who's just like, why don't you like just look at translation programs? I know you said it's just, you just like your fan stuff, you just want to like buy your manga and translate it, and like just look at it. And then I started looking at translation programs, and like the second I started reading, I was like, oh, we're gonna study translation theory and we're gonna look at these programs. And I'm just like, oh no, I want to do this. This is so cool. I want to do it so bad. Ended up applying and I got in. And then I also ended up getting into the JET program, so I deferred a year, did a year on the JET program to spend more time in Japan learning more like cultural, and you know, just being in Japan is great. I miss it so much. And then I came back and did my master's degree. But it was definitely that kind of like, fine, look at translation stuff, even though I don't want to do it. And I'm just like, oh no, I want to do it. So, so that ended up sending me to Kent State. I mean, I guess one other good boon too is my year in JET program was I had a miserable time. The teacher I was working with was just huge jackass. And I basically, like, after my first year was up, I was like, I can't wait to go to Kent. Like, let's go. If I'd had a great year on JET, I probably would have stayed for 5 years, and I'd probably still be there now. I probably would never gone into translation if I had stayed in JET. So in a way, my shitty year on JET was like the perfect transition into me having like a really great career as a translator. So like, you know, in a way, kind of thanks, sensei. But yeah. No thanks.
It's like poetic, you know. I've always had this kind of like weird fantasy in my head that like it, I feel like JET is some sort of weird, you know, rite of passage for like translators. Because like I feel like I feel like I've heard so many people talk about the JET program like for the longest time because they're like, oh, you get to live in Japan, you get to experience it and stuff. And it's like, and I've had mixed stories, like the story that you took, you know, you shared with me is one of those rare stories where it's like, well, it's not even rare, but I don't want to classify it as such. It's not just like all going to be like hunky dory, like, yay, it's going to be like an awesome program. There's a lot of challenges involved with that and trying to like incorporate yourself is not the right word, but kind of like learn the culture and kind of like be part of that culture. And it's, you know, it is a shock. Like I can only relate to this at the level that I level of the tourist. Like, for example, I remember when I went to Kyoto and Tokyo for like the very first time, like by myself. And I was like really super shocked, like how different Kyoto is in Tokyo when it comes to handling tourism, right? Like, you know, Kyoto is a bit more tourist friendly, and I go to Tokyo, everything is in Japanese, and I'm like, I can't read a single lick of Japanese here, which sucks. And I think I pissed off maybe a couple of people because I tried to speak to them in broken Japanese. And like, I remember going to Akihabara and trying to find like this hole in the wall tonkatsu place because I love tonkatsu.
Oh, and
apparently like this restaurant is like so small they could only accommodate like 3 or 4 people, and so I thought like it was going to be bigger than that, and so I just wandered into a closed bar and I tried to ask, and you know, the same question over and over to this old lady, and then the old lady slams her hand like on the table frustratingly and frustratingly said something in Japanese, and I'm like, okay, she's pissed, we're getting the fuck out of here.
Message received.
Yes, you know, that is, anger is a universal message that I understand, so I'm just gonna step away. This is obviously not the place. And even if you did say something in Japanese, I probably wouldn't understand where the hell this place is anyway, until I found it and realized like, oh, they can only fit like 3 or 4 people, which it is what it is. So okay, so wow, that's fascinating. So you were, so to be clear, you were in Japan for 6 months initially.
Yes.
And then
I went for 6 months. I came back for 6 months to graduate.
Okay.
And then I went back for a year.
Okay.
On JET. And then I went from JET. I flew home. I spent 3 days in LA repacking all my stuff. And then I flew to Ohio.
Okay.
To start my grad school. It was a very whirlwind experience and I would not recommend it. But it was great. And I always talk about how I got such a different experience between being a student in Japan and then being an adult, like working in Japan. Because as a student, I could get away with murder. I could skip class. I could get super drunk on like a Monday morning. Like, you know, we party. Like university students over there party hard. And I partied hard. I translated a lot of manga too. But I partied very hard. And it was really great, and I got to experience all the really fun parts of Japan without having to worry about the responsibility of like, oh, I have to pay my bills now, you know, because like all of my stuff was already paid with my student loans. I couldn't have to worry about the rent. I just had to show up to class, which was like 5 minutes away anyways, and just hang. And it was great. And I got to start. I joined the drama club, so I got to have all the bukatsu kind of experience. You know, I was close enough to Tokyo that I could take like a 3-hour train into Tokyo on the weekends, if I wanted to pay the money. It was expensive, but and I was out in the countryside, so there weren't a lot of English speakers, which was great for me and my Japanese. But then, of course, when I came back on the JET program, I was much further in the Inaka. I was up in a village in the mountains of about 1,500 people, kind of in the same area as my university, which was great because I knew the exact same supermarket and whatnot. I just had to drive an hour to get there, it was a much different experience, you know, being a lot more isolated, a lot more people not speaking English. At that point, my Japanese was already pretty fluent, so I didn't have an issue. But I would run into the other issue of people not knowing I was fluent.
I see.
So I would show up in places, and because this is the countryside, this was not a touristy countryside. This was like a place where Japanese tourists would go to visit, like to camp out for the weekend kind of thing. Like Yuru Camp, I think, actually has gone to a few campsites in the village that I lived in, which is really cool in Yamanashi. Yeah, there are times when I would walk into places and people, like, the color would drain from their face. It's like, oh, here comes this fucking white girl. Like, oh my God, what is she doing here?
Yeah.
And why, and how do I tell her to go away? And I should be like, and they're like, oh my God, like, oh, like, you see the, oh, thank God kind of thing.
Yeah. This a sigh of relief.
It was very interesting for me, you know, to, you know, coming as a white person from America, you know, where I don't experience that much discrimination based on my race. Going to different places in the Inaka in Japan. And again, I'm not trying to say this is an equivalent experience and whatnot, but it definitely gave me a little bit of a taste of like, oh, like just because I walked in somewhere, now I'm going to be treated in a completely different way, even though I just want to buy some groceries, you know? So it was definitely, it was very interesting for me. And then definitely being a very young woman in the workplace, there was only like 20 of us teachers at the middle school I worked at, but I was still expected to bring everyone tea in the morning because I was the youngest and I was a woman. Or when we went to Nomikai, I was the youngest and a woman, so I went and refilled everyone's drinks. And at first I was like, oh, this is so cool. Like, I'm participating in culture. And then by the end I was like, oh, this is such bullshit. Like, what the fuck? So, and then of course I also had to deal with like paying my bills, getting my internet set up and like dealing with my landlord. And there's all this other like stuff that really sucked at the time. But now that I'm translating, I can see like, oh, this character has to go like call the internet company. I know how shitty that is in Japan. So getting that kind of cultural knowledge, both good and bad, as both a student and as an adult, was really helpful for me going into translating media, because I don't have to do too much research on that. Like, I know a few things here and there. I think the best example of this was in our grad program. There were 10 of us, which is a huge class for the grad program. And two of us had never been to Japan. The rest of us had all lived there. And we had a translation assignment where we were translating some fiction. And there was a girl talking about like going on the subway in Japan. She's like, yeah, I just tapped my Suica, which is like the metro card, basically. Mm-hmm. And I went in and out and whatnot. And those two people who had not been to Japan had no idea what it was. So they translated as, like, oh, I tapped my watermelon card, like this, that, and the other
thing.
Oh,
no.
And we had to sit down and just be like, all right, guys, now this is why cultural research and cultural knowledge is really important, because everyone else in the class has been to Tokyo and has a Suica. And literally, like, six of us pulled our Suicas out of our wallets. Like, yeah, we still have ours.
Yeah.
And the two people hadn't been, just like, oh, shit, like, I didn't know. And it's like, yeah, well, if you run into something you don't know, you have to look it up. And, you know, look it up in Japanese, because then you'll find it. But it's very interesting to see, you know, firsthand, like, oh, like, when you don't experience a thing, when you have that lacking knowledge and you just assume something, like, your translation just ends up, like, totally crazy. So that cultural knowledge, not only of, like, if Japan, but, like, knowing all the how that stuff gets seen, like, in the US is also such a big deal. So, you know, we talk a lot about cultural knowledge when we're talking about translation.
We'll be right back after these messages.
I also think that there is a lot of value to learning, you know, a culture of what you're working with, because it adds so much more to your work. Like, you know, for example, I watch a lot of Rick Steves, and he's like a guy who's like known for covering Europe and stuff like that. Big travel dude. And he's a proponent of travel where you experience the actual culture of where you're going to. And this was like around like 2004 when I went with my parents to like Paris or something like that. And it's very interesting because, you know, for one thing, it's the way that I would describe the experience. It's very low impact in such a way that it's, you know, when compared to Japanese, because at least you can kind of understand the language, right, in terms of its letters and whatnot. It doesn't feel too foreign, but you can kind of glean, like, you know, some of the similarities and stuff. And I think by going there and just being part of the society and the culture, like going into non-tourist friendly restaurants or bars and whatnot, you kind of really get to see and observe like how people go about their daily lives. And I'm always in awe of people such as yourself who have done that, who walk the walk and talk the talk, so to speak, of being in that culture and really entrenching yourself in that, so that that way when you finally go to work on something, you have the proper context of like, yep, I know what a Suica card is. In fact, you know, I don't have one. I did like this silly like JR Rail Pass because I was a tourist.
Oh, the JR Rail Pass? Do not talk shit about the JR Rail Pass. That shit is awesome.
How was it?
You said you're like, oh, it's a silly pass. I'm like, oh no. Like when Gaijin lived in Japan, we were so jealous of like our friends would come to visit us. They're just like, oh, yeah, I got my JR pass. I'm just like, I had to pay like $200 to go into Tokyo the other day. Oh, I wish I could get a JR pass. Sorry, it's brought up some old memories of me being like, "What went so bad?"
Oh no! I absolutely relate to that because when I was researching like visiting Japan, and I've only really visited Japan like 3 times in my life. Maybe that's more than most people, but it's I feel like it doesn't compare to you living there and experiencing the culture still, right? Like, and the one time that I did research and stuff, like when I realized that, like the Nozomi like trains, buying a ticket there is like, $200-$300. I'm like, what the hell? And then I found out the JR rail is around the same price. You can't take the, you can't take the fastest trains, but it's good enough that you can take the bullet trains, it's still really good comparatively. And so, one day, like I had this really ambitious idea of like, I'm going to go to Tokyo all the way down to Okinawa. Well, I did not make it there. I like stopped like right where Himeji is and then went back because it was like, man, these stops are taking way too long. But anyways,
a long train ride.
Do you know like how long the train ride is like from Tokyo to Okinawa? Is it like a day?
Well, I know you can't get to Okinawa via train. You have to fly.
Okay.
But if you took the train all the way down to like the southernmost tip of like Japan and then flew, like if you're going from Tokyo to Hiroshima is like a good 3 hours. And that's not even all the way far south.
Really? Wait, yeah. 3 hours? Like,
yeah, well, I did it on the JR pass, so I had to take the little bit longer one, but yeah, it's a good time. I mean, Tokyo to like Osaka is still like an hour and a half. So, and like Osaka to Hiroshima is like a good hour.
Okay. Yeah, because I'm my memory is failing me because I personally thought like the trip from like Kyoto to Tokyo was long enough, I guess. But now you're laughing at me because it's like, no.
No, it's fine because like I didn't get to ride the Shinkansen very much when I was in Japan. Like when I lived there because A, it was expensive, and B, like I just didn't travel that much because I was always in school or, teaching. So a lot of my longer train rides are like, well, yeah, I took a 6 hour train up from Yamanashi up to Nagano to go visit a friend, passed out, like took like a 3 hour nap. Oh yeah. But no, I absolutely miss the trains. I actually took a class on the Japanese train system in college. It was by this professor who was this mega train otaku. It was hilarious. but I learned a lot about like the history of the Japanese train system and how it functions and whatnot. It was all really, really interesting. But it was so great going to Japan and getting to ride all the trains and like charting out all your different schedules and whatnot. And Google Maps is so good with train schedules now in Japan.
Nice.
It'll literally tell you which platform to go to and how much time you have between connections. And of course everything runs so on time there that you don't have to worry about being too late or too early. So can't recommend it enough. I miss it so bad. I just want to sit on a Japanese train. I just want to sit on the Yamanote for like an hour and just listen to all the chimes. Like, if you know, you know.
Absolutely. Like, when I did visit Japan, like, I'm always making sure that I'm really close to Yamanote line. Like, when I stay in Tokyo, so that way, because, there'll just be like a train coming in like every so often. And it is so nice compared to like California, where it's like you have your bus pass and everything. Looking at the bus schedule, you're like, where the hell is the bus? And I've lived there long enough and took the bus long enough to be like, okay, this is not working out for me. Like I need to, like, which is why a lot of people in California are like kind of forced to get a car because the public transportation just doesn't compare to like,
it's bad. It's really bad. Like when I was in school here, cause I've lived in LA all my life. I was born and raised here. And I'm back in LA, Lamau. When I was I went to UCI and I did an internship for my psych program at first I was taking the bus, but it was like a 3 hour bus ride because I had a transfer. So I get up at 5 a.m. and arrive at the daycare where I was interning at like 8. Then I would take the bus home and it would suck ass. But then I looked into it. It's like, they have like a special going on like Hertz or something where I could rent a car. That cut my commute down from 3 hours to 15 minutes.
Wow. That's incredible.
It's pretty bad. I mean, like, don't get me started on like class separation, like wealth discrepancies and like poverty and all this other shit. Like I could go into it, but it was just so crazy to me to be like, just because I have a car now, like I can sleep in another 2.5 hours versus now I have to get up early and like mess around on my phone for 2 hours waiting for this bus to show up.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's kind of like what I mean is like, you definitely get to appreciate the kind of infrastructure that they laid out in Japan and Tokyo specifically, like at least my experience, like and to be able to get around like so fast, like because it's not just the Yamanote line. There's also buses. There's, you know, like the train, the subway. The subway system is crazy. Like the first time I saw it, I was like, I can't believe I can go from Harajuku to like Asakusa, like in just a few minutes. Like it's really, it's really insane. Like how convenient everything is.
It's great. And I think too, like, obviously there are definitely places in Japan where you do need a car. Like the village where I was living, if you didn't have a car, you, there's one bus a day and that's it. So there's, Even in Yamanashi Prefecture, where they have some pretty decent trains going in the like the major cities, like Kofu's got some good trains. But like where I was out more towards Fujiyoshida, which is like where you would go to start climbing Mount Fuji. That's where Fuji-Q Highland is too, which is like big roller coasters and shit. It's awesome. There's one train line, and it just goes into the valley and then comes out. And it's only about every like every 15 minutes during rush hour, but like later in the day, like. Last train out of Otsuki to go down into the valley is like 9:30 p.m. You miss that and you're screwed. Like you're staying overnight in Otsuki now. So there's definitely places in Japan where, you know, it's not as amazing as it is in Tokyo. But it's definitely way better. And the good thing about too about their infrastructure is like even when I was a student, you know, I had no car or whatever, living in that kind of Inaka, I could take the train up to Otsuki. And then I could go anywhere in the country. So I took the train up 6 hours to go visit my friend in Nagano, took the train back down, and then went switched over to Shinkansen, go all the straight all the way down to like Kyoto kind of thing. So,
and it's almost like, you know, every, you know, you're talking about your time in the provincial towns and stuff like that. It's almost like they kind of, you know, tell their own story, because it's like, even though there's like a lack of transportation and whatnot there and you need a car, like, obviously, like, there's a reason why this convenience store is here. Or there's a reason why this, you know, these different kinds of businesses are here. And, you know, walking into those, you know that so many others have done the same thing as you. So there's almost this kind of history there that's almost untold, like, in the background, which is kind of poetic in a way. Technically, it's not, doesn't really compare, because this is still a very touristy place. But it's like, I remember going to Nikko and, like, realizing how further I am from like Tokyo, like when I got off the train and I'm just like, I know I have to go to this tourist spot, but the route from where from the train to the tourist spot is unclear. Like there's, you know, like I don't know where to go. It's like I guess at the time I thought to myself, oh, this is just gonna be like a quick, you know, a quick trip through this thing, not understanding that you also have to deal with the culture and the understanding of where to go, or even if you have a tour, you know, a tour guide book or whatever. And I wound up spending like all day there accidentally, just trying to figure out where to go, how to get there and how to get back, more importantly. But yeah. So, I mean, just Japan is fun. If you haven't been there, like check it out, you know, yeah, definitely. So let's go back to like your work, because I think, you know, that's one of the main reasons like why we're here. A lot of people are curious about localization in game development these days, probably more so than the previous years, to the point where like there's a lot of people who are doing armchair translating, which is, you know, it's a thing in and of itself. We discussed that earlier, having, you know, being only aware of the monolingual language and stuff. So I guess my question is like, say, I don't know, like 13 Sentinels. How long does like a game like that get translated and localized? Because like from what I remember playing that game, not only did you have to deal with like the dubbing or anything like that, but also just like lots and lots of text, and not just text. Like because of the way 13 Sentinels is, there's so much like obfuscation and abstraction to the story that is necessary for the storytelling. Like, how do you deal with something like that? Like, do you map it out? I'm curious.
So it's a game localization is such, it's like a hydra. There's like so many different heads that you have to kind of battle at the same time. And it's a really long process. And it really depends on the developer we're working with, or the team that we have, or even our production schedule. It's like, oh crud, we got like this big project coming up in 3 months. Like, we got to do this fast. So really our approach to how we would manage a project depends on, you know, what the project is and what time of the year it is. What I can say is it's longer than a year. You know, we'll do some pre-production stuff, you know, where we're able to talk with the devs, get some terminology going. Hey, do you have an alpha of your game? Like, what's going on? Can you send us like your main story summary? Just so we can start familiarizing ourselves with material. Because the more familiar you are as a translator with how the game works, and especially with something like 13 Sentinels, where you've got these major like story bombs in the beginning, which you have no idea what they mean until you get like halfway through the game, just like, oh shit, Juro is this person, like all this shit coming together. You really need to have your, especially for 13 Sentinels, where you really need to have people play through the game and be able to piece it together and go, okay, like here we go. Like, and it's interesting too, when you've got translators and editors who will adapt it for a dub or for the final English, you'll really need to sit down with them to be like, okay, here, like you have to leave very robust comments. It's like, especially anything involving time travel at all. Like you got to go and be like, all right, this if impacts this, this, and this, this line needs to be the exact same as it is in this person's route, like way farther in, because that's like, this is an extremely important line. So it's very important to have that kind of pre-production where everybody gets familiarized themselves with it. Understand what words are important, which ones aren't, what concepts we're really going to be pulling out throughout the whole kind of game. Basically becoming the biggest fans of the game before we even bring it to the West. And then from there, being able to determine, like, how do we want to handle certain terminology? How do we want to, you know, structure out, like, who's working on what? You know, for different games, you might have somebody going, okay, we're going to have these two, like, more experienced editors work on all of our main story. Side quests, we want this person to handle. Item descriptions, we're going to have this person handle. And then you've got other games, you know, like a 13 Sentinels or like an Octopath Traveler, where you're going to say, okay, well, like, I want this person handling this person's route, which might mean that editor A has to go talk to editor B and be like, okay, so this is, like, the alternate perspective of this in my one Octopath route. I need you to read what I've done, and then we need to work together to figure out how we're going to make it work for both of our characters. So it's the approach really varies between games. But 13 Sentinels was definitely a very interesting beast to work on, just because of how character-centric it is, how good the writing is, and all of those little breadcrumbs that Vanillaware will leave throughout the whole game until you get, like, the full piece of bread at the end.
Exactly. Like, I would call the game obfuscation the game, like, because it's such so beautiful when it comes to revealing things and then hiding a whole bunch of things for you to discover, and there's a magic to that. And I think I covered that in my review, and I said, like, I know, you know, it's very confusing right now, but that's mm-hmm. the joy of it. You have to embrace the confusion, because if you do, once you get to the end and all the reveals, it's like you're opening a new present every single time.
It's great. I think for me too, it's interesting because I participated on this project from more of a localization engineer and project management perspective. So I actually didn't do any translation or any writing for the dub. I wasn't present for any voice sessions. I was mostly on the back end, making sure that everything made it into the game correctly, that we were progressing smoothly. You know, and this is all stuff that I really love to do. So, like, the game is great, but it gave me this really interesting perspective into the game because, you know, I was juggling a couple different projects at the same time with engineering, so I wasn't 100% on 13 Sentinels. But as the game production started to ramp up and I was spending more and more time on it, I was starting to see more of the English translated text come into the game and kind of manage that. Every once in a while, I'd just be like, all right, guys, what the fuck is going on here? Like, I just read a scene where, like, a cat just gave someone a gun. Like, what's happening in this game? Because I hadn't played it yet, because I'm all on the back end and, like, management. And they're just like, oh, Katrina, you have to play it. You have to play it. It's so good. And then I remember my first time reading all the game text was actually when we were doing, I was engineering out our voice script before we were going to voice recording. It was the first time I had seen all the text of the game in one place. But again, because it's 13 Sentinels, it's all out of order.
Yeah.
You know? So the way that, you know, all of the voice script was in, like, I didn't really get to see it in the intended order that Vanillaware had put it in. So I'm reading the scene, and also I'm just like, wait, hold on. Like, what the fuck is going on here? Like, I remember I was reading through the whole thing to do all my engineering and make sure everything was working properly. And I was just like just constantly messaging the team, just being like, and they were loving it. They're just like, Katrina, like, we want to know, like, your non sequitur reactions to all this shit. And I'm just like, I have no idea what the fuck is happening. And it wasn't until, like, we were, like, halfway through recording, I was like, you know what, like quarantine had just, like, was starting, and I was like, okay, I need, like, something to do. And I was like, I'm buying the Japanese version so I can figure out what the fuck's going on in this game. And originally it was just me playing in Japanese on our PS4. And then my fiance started sitting with me, and then I would translate for him while I was playing, which is a really fun exercise for me.
Yeah.
But it was great because like we'd get into certain sections where like especially the Goto sections where like Goto would start going on this like far like 40 line monologue. And I'd be like, hold on, babe, I need to read like all of this before I can explain it. He's like, okay, I'll just wait. And I'm just like, oh shit, oh, I saw that in the voice. Oh shit, that's what this is. And it's just like these truth bombs coming back to me. And it was just like, it was so much fun. It like the game was so good. And then I think the best part about it too is once it released was being able to go through and play it with the English dub. And being able kind of doing that like Captain Kirk pointing me whenever I would see like a certain string that like I really battled with getting back into the game or like a certain line that we were all talking about, just like, oh, that piece of shit line, like I've seen that line like 8,000 times, like, oh man. So it was such a trip working on that project. It was really, really challenging, but like our team, like all of our translators, all of our editors, and especially like Mason, our project manager, like they killed it. Like it was a really difficult project. And lots of blood, sweat, and tears, especially going straight into pandemic. But it came out so great, and I'm so glad more people are playing it now, because this is like top three games of like my entire life. It's like definitely number one or number two.
I mean, I don't know if you saw the Backlog Battle Awards, but like that was my game of the year from last year. Like it was like the hands down. Oh, it was like, yeah, there's nothing that really competed with it. Like I was hemming and hawing, like, oh, should I give Scott a bone and say Yakuza like a dragon? But yeah, let's, you know, yeah, 13 Sentinels is pretty damn good.
Oh man, I'm a terrible Sega employee because I still have not played Yakuza like a dragon. I've
got to. I hope Scott doesn't listen.
I've seen so many. I'm sorry, Scott. I need to play it. I know. It's been on my backlog, but I keep going back to my comfort games.
Yeah.
Eventually I'll go to my Yakuza. My friends are playing and they're sending me fun screen caps. So, you know,
that's great.
That counts.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think so. So I think what one of the things I want to talk about then is your team's relationship with the developers, because the thing that's kind of really crazy to me is, or, you know, some of the things that I've seen on Twitter and online in general is as if you guys are just working autonomously doing your own thing with localization without the aid of the developers. And I've always felt like, no, that's not true. Like, you know, they still need to kind of understand where they're coming from. And that requires constant conversation and communication. So you don't have to go into specifics and stuff. My question is, could you give us a little bit more of like an insight as to how that works, even in abstract ways? Because I want to give people the idea that you guys aren't in a bubble. You guys are affected by everything around you.
Absolutely not. No, and this is actually something I've been discussing a lot and doing a lot of research on, is this working with the developers and whatnot. And obviously nothing happens in a vacuum. This isn't the super old days where like as soon as something goes gold in Japan, they're just like, here, take it, goodbye. And then you never hear from them again unless you like fax them some questions. And again, it really depends on the project. But we're seeing with localization, not just at Sega, but like across the board, this shift now from what's called waterfall localization, which is where, you know, they finish the goal, they go, here's the game, we haven't released it yet, but it's pretty much done, you could talk with us, but we're not changing much, to agile localization, which is localization in tandem with development. So like every week it's like, okay, what changed? Oh, you changed this guy's backstory. Okay, now we need to go back and relocalize that. So there's just been this real shift, like I said, not just at Sega, but like all these other game companies now. I mean, you look at Square Enix and pretty much everything they're doing is simultaneous shipping, or sim ship. Nintendo obviously is sim ship. Like, you know, Animal Crossing is, you're not waiting 3 months for it to come out in Japan and come out to the English speaking world. So we're seeing this industry-wide shift from that waterfall method to agile. And when you make that shift, you really need to be working with your developers. Because there's no way that you're going to be able to get them to come out at the same time if you're not communicating. And I think anybody who's working game development knows how much stuff can change on a dime. You know, you're working with writers and stuff. You haven't figured out this full story, or you do the whole main story and you realize, oh, but like by the end of this game, like this guy's motivation doesn't work. So you go back in and do a whole bunch of workshops to try and figure out how you're going to rework this character to better fit the narrative. And a lot of this game development, even in like the English like development world, you don't think about how that cascades down to your localizers. You know, you don't realize, oh, we decided to make this character like he was a boy before, but now he's a girl. You just fucked your French translators, your Italians, your Spanish, your German, like anybody who has a gendered language does now have to go through and redo all that, and they can't do it automatically. They have to go do it manually. So there's a lot especially with like developers nowadays, as we're moving into this agile, they really don't understand how even what they think is a very small change can really like disrupt stuff down the workflow for localization. And if you want to release at the same time, that might mean you make a small change. Now you're waiting a month to release because Locus is catching up. So we're really putting a lot more emphasis industry-wide on this collaboration with developer, not just during development, but in pre-development. So before even you've got your game engine running, even before you've decided to use Unity, you're talking with the writers and going, what's the gist of the game? Oh, you want to do a fantasy game where you're talking about racism between elves and dwarves. We need to fucking talk about that because we've got racism issues over here in the US. Like, let's talk about how we're handling that. So you're going into this very early discussions with writers and developers about like, okay, like for example, like if we were developing something that's very graphic, like assets or very, very highly stylized, like this is a bad example, but like the P5 like menus and whatnot are very highly stylized, or like even Cyberpunk 2077 has some really highly stylized elements. Like you want to go in at the earliest available stage with those designers and be like, how are you designing these and how much space do we have to expand? Because we have German translators who are going to be putting this into German, and we need to find the right word and the right word length to fit a lot of these German expanded words, because they will tend to get longer, you know, the more complex you want to get. So there's a lot of pre-production work that we're trying to start doing now with these companies. And one big thing for me, I know I'm going on and on about this, is content management. And what I usually could say is like string formatting. Because way back in the olden days, like a Japanese developer might throw their source code at you and just be like, here, well, the text is in there somewhere. Just like translate it. And translators would literally go into the source code of the game, delete like the Japanese, and then type in the English, which is so scary because you delete the wrong semicolon, or like anyone who's programmed before knows, like it's so easy to mess up code.
Yeah.
And then back then, you know, you send it off to the developer, and the developer's like, well, now our game doesn't load on the PS2. What the fuck's going on? Now you have to crawl through all these lines of code to figure out who deleted the semicolon. And even nowadays, especially coming out of Japan, like Excel is kind of king. They'll take whatever they have in their proprietary management system. They'll export it into an Excel. They'll be like, here's our Excel spreadsheet with 200 tabs and 200,000 Japanese characters. Please translate our entire game, this one file. And in the past, we were able to do that, but Excel is really not the best container of data. So industry-wide, we're seeing a big shift into using more proprietary content management systems. Xloc is one of them. They're like a web-based system where developers can put their strings into it. You can download like an XLIF, which is an XML container for translation software that we're using, and it'll do all the conversion stuff. But we're seeing a lot more proprietary stuff as well, like internally. I know Nintendo has their own proprietary tool for content management. A couple of our developers have their own proprietary tools as well. But really, like being able to organize the data for localization in a way that's not only easy for us to read, but also easy for all of our software to read. Like we're using MemoQ, which I have a love-hate relationship with, but it's great. We like MemoQ most of the time. But really putting a focus on these developers to start using these methods of delivering this data to us versus like, don't send us the source code. You have to get in there really early in pre-production to be like, okay, you guys are using Unity. Here are some tools that'll help you like get your strings in and out of the Unity engine, but also give us an easier way to kind of work with strings. On top of that, like having those better systems makes it easier for the devs to add stuff in for localization. For example, like in World of Warcraft, your character can be either male or female. And depending on what language you're playing in, you know, the gender of whatever character you're playing is going to affect all your adjectives, all your plurals, like all these other words down the line. So they have to implement different variables for different adjectives and whatnot, so it can change based on the gender of your character, which is just like a variable like M or F or whatever. So having those really robust systems, whether they're like an XML coming straight out of a development engine or like an Xloc type engine that is built for localization, helps make sure that those issues don't come up down the line. Because again, like this pre-production process is happening 1, 2, even 3 years before they're even starting to get us anything that we can work on. But the earlier we can intervene and be like, hey, like you want your Yakuza game to do really well in English, then we need to work together to make sure it does. Because if we don't, then all of a sudden we're looking back at our waterfall schedule where they're dropping this huge game in your lap, and now all of a sudden you're seeing all these issues. Like, oh, well, now, like, German can't fit their terminology in. How are they going to work with that? And it's a lot more reactive than proactive. And that's when you start getting a little bit more awkwardness. You know, you get a lot of devs going like, well, we're crunching to try and make our submission deadline in Japan. We don't have time to handle the Germans. Like, they could deal with it. So you get a lot more give and take versus if you really intervene early in the process. So industry-wide, there's a big push to get in as early as development. Like, if you guys know, like, the second, like, your director says, like, I want to make a new Mario game, it should be like, you call your localizer. Be like, we're making a new Mario game. Let's talk.
Yeah. That's really cool. Like, so to give you a background of where I came from in terms of development, like, I have only gone so far as QA. But that doesn't mean that I never actually had to QA, efigs, because that's a thing that people dealt with.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. QA is like, yeah, can you just play the whole game in Russian? I don't speak Russian, but can you just make sure it works and doesn't crash?
Right. And make sure, yeah, like, there's no English there. And then, of course, like, if there's English there, it's like, no, it's actually the same in, like, German or French and stuff. And be like, okay, whatever, you know, having no knowledge of that. And so I had to do that for a whole bunch of games. And I think what's actually interesting is that was the era of the waterfall kind of method of localization that you're describing, because we had to literally, like, focus on the English SKUs and stuff, like, get that out there. And then now it's the figs, turn, like, French, Italian, German, and Spanish for the people who are listening. And so, you know, and I'm really glad to hear that. And I feel like I've known, even just by the implication of how a lot of conversations about game localizations happening these days, that yes, of course the localization teams have to be there during pre-production, because as you said, if you ask them, you know, much later on, you know, everybody crunches towards the end of a game's lifetime. And that's not the part of the development where we need to cram new features. That's the part where we got to rip it apart and remove features that we feel aren't working. You know, I don't know if you agree with this, but, like, my history with game development, at least my experience, is like, hey, here's all these features we want to implement. Beta comes and it's like, it's time to remove shit because we got to submit this sometime soon, you know?
Yeah.
So it makes so much sense. And I do appreciate the additional insight to this, because I think everybody needs to kind of understand that people aren't working in Excel anymore. Like, yes, fan translators.
Well, it depends on the company.
Okay. Okay, I shouldn't say that. People are, let me rephrase it. People are striving. Yes, thank you. People are trying to move out of Excel. And I think these proprietary solutions are actually great, because I feel like you guys being entrenched since the very beginning is literally moving towards the next goal, which is, you know, day one for everybody, day one releases for everybody. And it makes so much sense, because, like, if you're already there in the beginning, then why not release it for everybody by the end of the day? Like, you know, I'm not going to belabor you with a lot of the complaints that I hear about SMT5, like, not being out yet, because that's a whole thing entirely. But even from the very beginning, I told my community, I'm like, the reason why they're taking this long is because they're fucking working on all the languages at the same time, because it's launching all at the same damn time. Do you understand how difficult that is? And so I think it's, you know, having this conversation would be, I do hope that it enlightens people's understanding of the localization process in games.
Absolutely. But I think, as we're moving towards more simultaneous stuff, and again, this is industry-wide, this is not just Sega, that I think, like you said just now, it's like, oh, well, it's taking so long because they're working on all the languages. And in an agile environment, that's actually not true. Usually, and this is actually something I got from a talk from the distinguished speaker at ATA's conference this year, is that localization is typically 1 to 2 agile sprints behind the development team. So we're actually working much closer to when the devs are done than not. In a simultaneous shipping environment, where, like, the devs are like, here, we added, like, 3 new side stories this week, and then boom, we get in, we do the 3 side stories, like, we're done 2 to 3 weeks after they put that content in. So when a game, like, I can't talk anything about SMT5, I'm actually not on that project, so I have no idea what's going on with it. When we're looking at stuff that is coming out simultaneously, most of the time when there is a delay, it is not on localization, it's absolutely on developers. But that's not to say that if the devs come to us and go, yeah, we're, like, reworking the entire main plot and we've decided to change the battle system now, so instead of turn-based, it's, like, like not turn-based anymore. It's going to be like open world. Like, well, that like that's completely going to fuck localization, obviously. Yeah. But that's not going to delay it too much. Like, you know, the devs still have to create all that content for us to translate, but we're going to be right behind them working on it. I think there's a lot of discussion to be like, oh, well, like if we're moving to SimShim, now we're going to have to wait, like seeing the game content. Like, and even the developers will say stuff like that too. Just like, well, why should I wait for you guys to finish your look to release it? If we're ready to go gold, why are we waiting for you guys? And obviously, you know, we can throw the sales numbers at them. We can throw this, that, and the other thing at them. And they're starting to understand, especially smaller developers who are not used to this kind of SimShip model, this agile model. It's definitely trying to get that misconception of like, no, it's rarely ever our fault. Like, we're at the end of the train. It's kind of like with QA. It's like when the devs are on fire, like QA and Loc just get shit on. Like, it's like, okay, I guess we're just going to wait for them to figure out what they're doing with this aspect. Or, okay, well, if they want to rewrite the main story again, I guess we'll just see what it is. And we'll just kind of like scrap all the testing and all the Loc we've already done. So, yeah. And like I said, I can't speak for any specific project or specific thing. But like, usually when there is a delay that massive, it's due to development. It's not due to something in QA or something in Loc. I mean, you look at Cyberpunk 2077, that was not QA. Like, QA got fucked in that project. Like, I could go on about that for an hour. Like, I have so many friends in QA, and we were just all just devastated when they're like, oh yeah, it's like our QA team wasn't doing a good job. And it's like, you guys could have waited. You guys could have taken another year for QA, but you decided to throw them under the bus and release. I don't know. I could go on and on, but like, usually if a project is getting delayed, it's not QA. It's not this. It's some developer on the team or some creative director was like, well, I want to redo this, and we're not releasing the game in this current state. Like, we need to redo a whole bunch of shit. And that means you got to go through all your creative process. You got to go through your development, your implementation. As soon as it's implemented, you got to send it to QA, which sends it back to implementation. It's all over again. So it's such a huge ecosystem, so dependent on development. Like, your localization team is going to be like 6 to 10 people max. And your dev team is like, what, 100, 200 people all creating assets and all this other shit. So, you know. I don't know. Maybe I'm getting defensive. It's not us,
no,
I swear.
No. I do appreciate the context, because it's like, you know, you are right. Because like, after you guys like get the text and the strings and stuff like that, it still needs to be implemented in the game. And who does that? Well, the development team, of course. So it's like, it all comes back to the development team, the programmers and everybody, all the engineers that are working on it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I am sorry if I misrepresented the localization teams.
It's totally fine. But yeah, no. And again, industry wide, we're usually pretty close behind the development team when they're putting new stuff in, to the point where sometimes we're just twiddling our thumbs waiting for them to put content in. But yeah, no. And it's making the move from waterfall to simultaneous shipping has been very, very interesting industry wide to see how people are handling it. And really, depending on the development studio, some development studios have these really great processes already built in. From what I've heard from Square Enix, like, they're, especially for like Final Fantasy 14, they're like, they've got their own dedicated lore expert. Like, they're working super close with the Japanese team. Like, they let the English team name stuff or like give them ideas to put stuff in. So they're working really hard in tandem to make sure that, you know, while they're developing content, they're thinking about how that's going to get localized. And because of that, we've really seen how 14's localization has been so good. You know, they're getting stuff out on time. You know, it's so interesting to see how these other teams are handling stuff like simultaneous shipping, because it is starting to become the future of localization. Is like, we shouldn't be seeing something released 2 years ago that's finally getting an English release like tomorrow. Like, this is not going to be how our industry is going to survive. So it's very interesting on the project management front, but that's what I'm really passionate about. So,
so you're passionate about project management?
I am. That's actually I love translating. I love translation theory. But you know, the more I work in the industry, the more I'm realizing, like, you know, it's really helpful to translators and editors to have these processes and these projects managed well. Because like you said, if you don't manage it well, you get to the end of the game, now everyone's crunching 12-hour days just to try and get through all the shit so it can get submitted. I did some project management classes in my master's program. I've really enjoyed some of the management that I've been able to do at Sega. I've got a couple unannounced projects that I am doing some project management for right now, which is really cool. It's definitely one of my career goals in gaming is to go more localization production than being one of the lead translators myself, because I do enough of that on the side anyways.
Right. That's really awesome, because like, that puts a smile on my face, because I do feel that project management is severely underrated in the industry, and people need to do a lot more of that. And And so in a way, I'm not so surprised that, of course, you bring up Yoshi P's pet project all these years, because he is, like, to me, the, you know, like the bomb, like, project manager out of, like, everybody in the industry that I've seen. Like, who can say, like, what is it now? It's like the third, technically, like, it's like the fourth expansion if you count like A Realm Reborn as an expansion, for him to hit like all his goals, to be like, you're gonna get a patch for, you know, for a whole 18 months and then take a break, then we release an expansion. And he's been at it for like since Heavensward, like all the way up to Shadowbringers. It is insane. And I'm pretty sure you've researched a lot about, you know, like his processes to kind of really understand like how he manages like everybody's time. And to me, like, you know, I have nothing but profound respect for that. And in, to hear you working towards to that, like, just makes me really happy. It's really cool.
Yeah, I would pay premium bucks to get like either Yoshi P or like Koji Fox, like, sit down and just be like, all right, like, let's go, give me some notes. Yeah. Yeah. I want to learn so much from you right now.
Yeah. Can I shadow you just for like a week to figure out?
Oh, absolutely. So. Well, like, Koji Fox is like, he's just so cool. Like in charge of localization on this huge project, like, super passionate about it, gets to go to all the different events. Like, he freaking sings on the tracks in the soundtrack. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
That's what I want to be, Koji Fox. Just, just let me, like, get isekai, like, get the truck hit me and let me isekai into like a Koji Fox type thing. Like, that would be amazing. I've got some time before I hit that, but like,
have you met Koji Fox?
I have not met Koji Fox, and if I did, I'd probably make a fool out of myself.
I remember I met him for the first time in the first Final Fantasy 14 fan fest, and I asked like the dumbest question, because like I was like, I think I was talking about like how they would introduce Ninja in A Realm Reborn, and I'm like, how do you deal with that in story? And he's like, it's just a matter of text, man. And I'm like, of course it is, because that's your thing, man. So that was a great conversation, and hopefully in a future FanFest, if you do go, you do get to meet him, because he is such great man.
No, I was actually planning on going to my first FanFest. I have a love-hate relationship with 14. I stopped playing after Stormblood came out, because I was like, oh, this is like not fun to play anymore. And then Shadowbringers happened, and everyone's like, you have to play Katrina, you have to play. And I'm like, fine. And I played it, and it was fantastic. And people who aren't seeing me on video can't see my gigantic Graha shrine behind me. I have a problem. And I actually just recently stopped playing again, because our raid group was not doing very well in the last year, and I was just, like, not having fun anymore. But this was going to be the first year I was just like, all right, like, I actually care about 14 again. I wanted to, like, get some Graha merch. Like, let's fucking go. And then, of course, Graha.
Yeah.
But
that's awesome.
Yeah, no, I definitely have to go to the next one whenever it happens.
But. For sure. And to be absolutely clear to people who are listening right now, this time around, I did not bring up Final Fantasy 14. It's an ongoing thing, like on the show where I try to sell people to play Final Fantasy 14. Katrina did all of that. I wash my hands off of Final Fantasy 14 talk for this episode. And yes, she does have a Graha shrine like behind her.
He's a cute cat boy, and he's the best.
You know, what's really crazy is we've only really talked about like game localization and your experience with it. That we could do like literally another episode talking about anime and manga translation. But I do feel as though, like, you know, our conversation really kind of opened some eyes to people and kind of realized like this isn't just like people behind their desks, like, you know, by themselves trying to translate an entire game. It's like an entire team that works really hard to make sure that our experience with these games coming from Japan and you know, technically on other places too, are, you know, is as close to the original as possible. And I do want to thank you for sharing all this info, because I think the additional context is important, especially for people to just really appreciate their games more. I've always felt that going behind the scenes and figuring out how games are made and stuff and how games are localized even, like, really almost like increases the value of something that you just played. Like, it turns it into something more. It turns into like a, you know, a labor of love by all the people that that worked on it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I definitely say, like, my time in the game industry, even just working in localization, has made me appreciate so much more like the stuff that our developers come out with. Like, I'm a huge fan of Cyberpunk 2077, which obviously had their really disastrous launch. But I think one thing that really made it for me was, you know, I've been looking forward to this game for a long time. And for me, it's all about the writing and the story and whatnot. So, of course, like, that wasn't too badly impacted by a lot of the bugs and whatnot that happened. But for me, you know, even though there were bugs and whatnot, like, I was just so incredibly amazed by the stuff that the developers were able to do. Like, there's so many technological achievements in that game that, like, I from tangling with certain things like that with our own developers, it's like, I can't believe they made this happen. Like, yeah, sure, like, cars will teleport in and out, like, whatever, QA can we can fix that in QA, but, like, the fact that they were able to get just the scale and the size and, like, some of the AI going on in there, I don't think people realize, like, how difficult a lot of the stuff that they have implemented was. Just absolutely mind-boggling what they've done, and it's really been overshadowed by a lot of these what I consider just very little things. Like, yeah, no, that's minimal. Like, I know how some people feel about it, but, like, that is not, definitely not a big deal to me, at least. So, no, it definitely opened my eyes to, once you see how the sausage is made, you can really appreciate sausage a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a great way to kind of, you know, put a cap in our conversation about, you know, game development and game localization in general. So I do want to thank you for joining us, because this is, again, this has been a blast. And I want people to know where they can find you, because you do, like I said in earlier this episode, like, you do kind of provide a lot of really good insight to not just, you know, game localization and development, but also just localization in general. So do you want to share to us, like, how people can find you online?
Yeah, I'm most active on Twitter. I'm Katrina L, translator, which is stylized as TRNSLHR. But if you just look for, like, Katrina translation on Twitter, you'll find me. I'm a big nerd. I post a lot about translation theory. I'll talk about the shows I'm working on. Nowadays, I post a little bit more about anime and manga, just because that's one more free to talk about. Like I said, most of the stuff that I'm working on in video games, like, is stuff that hasn't been announced and won't even be out for, like, 1 or 2 years, because I'm working on all the pre-production stuff. But I'm more than happy to, you know, at me about translation, at me about, you know, stupid stuff, at me about Graha. I'm disgusting. But yeah, no, I'm most active there. I have a website too, if you'd like to contact me. That's the best way to get to me, is through my contact. There's a link on my Twitter profile. And yeah, no, if I'm always down to just talk translation and, you know, geek out. I'm a professional weeb. Let's go.
Professional weeb. maybe that's how I should have introduced you at the very beginning. All right, again, so thank you so much, Katrina, and thank you to everybody who's joined us for this show. Remember, we always release new episodes of the podcast every Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific time. We haven't missed a single beat yet, so we'll see you guys next week, all right, for the next episode. So until then, have a good one, and happy gaming.